Now, on the first missionary journey that we looked at in the previous chapters, we had Paul and Barnabas, and their names were ended up round in that way because Paul was taking the lead. Though it's interesting here that Barnabas is back in the lead for a moment there in Jerusalem. But we have Paul and Barnabas. They were going through Turkey, and they went to a place called Pisidian Antioch. And from Pisidian Antioch, they went east. They moved back towards Syria, where their own home church was, the church in Syrian Antioch. However, when they were at Pisidian Antioch, had they chosen to go north, they might have reached a completely different city. They might have reached the city of Gordium. Now, Gordium was an ancient city, and there was a famous king who once did something there. Anybody have the faintest idea what this king did in the city of Gordium?
Alexander.
Alexander arrived there, but there was a king prior to him, but we could go with him. What did Alexander do in the city of Gordium?
He either untied or undid, which is different things, the knot the king had tied.
That's right. In the city of Gordium, there was a chariot, so it said. I assume it was there. And this chariot had been tied up by an ancient king. And it was tied with a very intricate knot. And this ancient king had said, whoever unties this knot, that man will conquer Asia. And the story goes that Alexander the Great, who came from Macedonia, so the north of Greece, he arrived in 330 BC, and he succeeded. And in fact did go on then to conquer large parts of Asia. He succeeded with the knot. The only thing is, it's questioned as to how he succeeded. There's a possibility that he managed to untie the knot, or there's a possibility that he pulled out his sword and said, it doesn't say how I should untie it, and just sliced into it, and it was done. He untied the knot. Now, the myth, or the story of that, gave rise to a phrase. Anybody know what the phrase is, still in English?
Cutting the Gordian knot.
So if everybody who doesn't know that, you'll immediately need to go to Google and find out what it means. Or you can just wait and I'll tell you. Cutting the Gordian knot means this. You face some circumstances which look like they cannot be solved. They are insoluble. And then someone comes with an answer. Probably an answer you couldn't even see. You were faced with a situation, you thought, well, I don't know what to do, this is impossible, we can't fix this, we can't solve this. And then somebody comes in and they solve it. Like Alexander walking in to that city after centuries have gone by and saying, I can undo that knot. And then he takes his sword and cuts the Gordian knot. You may have experienced this at points. You may have experienced the personal relationship which had entered a phase where you thought, this can't be solved. It has just gone bad. I don't know how to heal this. And then suddenly, in some way, it was healed. Or maybe you were in an argument and you couldn't see how the argument would ever end. It was just going to carry on like some terrible feud. And then it was solved in some way, brought it to an end. Maybe you've been looking for something in your job, in your workplace, and you thought, it just seems I'm hitting a brick wall the whole time. It's insoluble. I can't see what the answer is. Somebody steps in and gives the answer. They have cut the Gordian knot for you. And it's such a relief when somebody does that. Now, if you can recapture that emotion that you felt if that happened to you in your life, then maybe you'll have something of an idea of what's happening in Acts 15. Because in Acts 15, James is doing that for the early Christian church. They have reached a point where it looks like no one can deal with the problem. How are they going to solve the argument? And James steps in and brings relief. So we're going to take this in two parts. I'm going to describe the hard problem they were dealing with, and then I'm going to tell you James's solution. The problem in Acts 15 is this. There is a conference going on in Jerusalem of Christians, both from Jerusalem and from the church in Syrian Antioch, and maybe folk from elsewhere too. They have come together to discuss this issue. Should Gentiles, who have become believers in Jesus, also become Jewish. We talked a lot about that last week, and indeed on Wednesday as well. I'm not going to go into all the details, but that's the summary of the question. There are Jewish believers, the first followers of Christ, because remember, Christ was Jewish, and he came first to Jewish people, and it was first Jews who became Christians. There were Jewish Christians in Jerusalem who said, "We're pleased that Gentiles are believing in the King, the Lord Jesus. We are pleased that God seems to be at work amongst them, but clearly now they must join us. They must become Jewish." And in particular, the great badge of Judaism, the Gentile Christian men need to be circumcised. But also, there's some other laws we need them to come in under. Some food laws and some other things. And so, Christians have come together in Jerusalem to debate this question. Now already, last time we heard Peter speak. He stood up, he said, "I don't agree with this. That's not how God worked. I saw God make Gentiles clean in his sight. I don't think they need to become Jewish to be clean before him. He's made them clean by his Spirit." We've heard Paul and Barnabas give a summary of the things they've seen done among Gentiles, a summary of their mission trip. So the apostles have stood up and said, "No, we do not agree with this. We are not going to go back to Turkey and start circumcising Gentile Christians. It should not be done." But what does the church in Jerusalem think? The first church there ever was. Remember, we are 18 years on from the death and resurrection of Christ, maybe. The church in Jerusalem has changed from those early days. In the early days, it was all the apostles, wasn't it? The apostles were laying the foundations for the Christian church that would grow worldwide. The apostles were fully involved in the life of the Jerusalem church. They were its shape, its form. But we're years on now. There are apostles and elders, we're told. The apostles themselves have become mobile. May have taken about 12 years or something like that, if the history books are right, that for a while they were settled in Jerusalem, but they are mobile now. Peter's been off to other places. Peter's been on the move. Maybe the others have as well. And the Jerusalem church has leaders, has elders of their own. And one of them is the brother of Jesus, a man called James. So what do they think? It's all very well the apostles saying, "Well, this is where it's at," but will the Jerusalem church follow their lead? James himself is under a lot of pressure. There are, as we read, Christian Jews in Jerusalem who are saying, "You must not give way on this." Jews and Gentiles have long lived separated lives. God would have it that way, James. You can't give way on this, James. You can't suddenly overturn our history. You can't suddenly overturn our culture. You can't threaten everything we're about, James. James, you know what the Old Testament law says. We can't offer worship alongside Gentiles. But what does James think? Is he with the apostles? Or is he against them? Are they going to clash? Or find a way to go forward together? In verse 13, when they finished, James spoke up. There will be people in that room who aren't sure, maybe, what he's about to say. You know, when Paul was up in Antioch, there were some, he said, who came from Jerusalem. This is in Galatians 2, and they said, "We've come from James. And Gentiles need to be circumcised." Well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't come from James. What's he going to say now? If you look up James in your history books, you will know that James was a very devout man, a very devout Jewish man. He was famous for it within the city. He became very well known, not just amongst Christian Jews, he became known generally. Within Jerusalem. He was a careful law keeper. He was careful at the temple. So what does James think? In verse 13, there is this knot that has to be untied, the knot of how the Jews and Gentiles are going to relate. The apostles say, it has to be like this, but others are saying, no, it doesn't. Will James find a way to untie the knot and bring the two together? So when you read verse 13, see it as a tense moment. It's a summary. We don't know exactly how it played out. But in terms of how Luke's telling it, it's a tense moment. Arguments have raged. Voices have been raised. There's not a solution yet. And the question is, will James make it worse? Well, here's what he says. Brothers, listen to me. Simon has described to us how God at first showed his concern by taking the Gentiles, a people, for himself, from the Gentiles. He actually calls him Simeon, which you'd expect, because James is a good Jewish man, so he uses the Jewish version of Simon's name, Simeon being the ancient tribal leader. And he says, God has taken from the Gentiles a people for himself. People is a trigger word. If James says people, then that's more than maybe we might hear that word. Because for them, the people are those whom God embraced in Israel. The people are the people of God, the people of Israel. And if James is now saying, no, I think God has taken a people for himself, he is putting the Gentiles on par with the Jews. So when James utters those first words, maybe Simeon, Simon, Peter, depending on which name you want to call him by, and Saul or Paul or whatever name you want to call him by, breathe a sigh of relief. James is on board. One stage has been passed. And yet, something still hangs in the air. It's all very well, James saying, so yes, I've heard the testimony. I believe what Simon says. I believe that God has worked among the Gentiles. I think he has saved some of them. He has made them his people. The question is, will he still insist on separation? Because that is something Paul can't abide the thought of. It's great that James is saying the Gentiles have also been shown mercy by God. But will he let Jew and Gentile mix? For Paul, that is a massive issue. When Peter refused to eat with Gentiles in Antioch, Paul took him out front and faced him down and said, you're going to stop doing this, because that is not what the Lord taught you. Is he going to have to do the same with James? Is James going to say, the Gentiles are a people of God, but we Jews, we can't mix with them? Or can he find an answer that will satisfy all the law keepers amongst the Christians in Jerusalem? Can James, the good Jew, find a way to mix with Gentiles? Or must a separate Gentile church be established? Will Jerusalem and Antioch go different ways? And that's when James comes up with his new solution, his answer. That's when James pulls out the sword and cuts the Gordian knot. Verse 15, the words of the prophets are in agreement with this. James says, and I'm sure that God had already told us to do this. Now, let's pause there, and just to be encouraged. A Christian's life and a church's life is in the hands of God. One of the things that means is what we're seeing in this passage. We do not have to solve every problem in our own strength. We look to him, and he can solve the problems we face. When life seems dark, when life seems broken, when life seems unfixable, when we seem to be in an argument that cannot end, a relationship that cannot be healed, you remember situations like this. You think of how strong the forces were in Acts 15. Jewish people did not mix with Gentiles. James was a loyal, faithful Jewish man. It would take a lot. It would take a massive thing for him to say, I'm popping around a Gentile's house. But the Lord worked in the situation, and what seemed impossible became possible. We have to believe this. Within our lives, we have to keep trusting the Lord that he can mend what we think is unmendable, that he can untie what we think is too tightly tied ever to be unknotted. We look at our lives. We find our lives sometimes, and we find ourselves upset within them, tearful. And it feels that the circumstances we're in, there's like a pressure that has built, and it's 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 too much! And under the stress of it, we cannot see an answer. It just overwhelms us, the problem. Maybe it's a financial issue. And we think to ourselves, this just cannot be solved. I'm just going to crash financially. I just can't. There's no way through this. Maybe it's a working problem. We're in a job where we just cannot imagine how we're ever going to be able to step out of this job. But the job itself is horrendous. Alternatively, we just cannot find a job. Or we're in a situation where we're facing something. We're facing an interview we've got to go to. We're facing a meeting we're going to have to go into. We're facing a test we've got to sit. And it just seems too much. It's not possible to handle this. It's not possible to cope with this. It's overwhelming. We're in our family, and our family feels under strain. And it's a strain that just feels it's going to snap. There is no answer here. It's just going to snap. We've got some health matter within our life. And it seems like it is far more powerful than we are, and it will destroy us. Or maybe it's just a one-to-one disagreement. And it's somebody we've argued with, we've spoken words, they've spoken words. We're not coming back from that. There are times when the way ahead seems impossible for us to see. Now what happens to us, sort of physically, emotionally, mentally? Well, our mind can maybe close in. It feels like there's a mist that has come down upon us. Everything seems cloudy, we don't see the way through. For some of us, that will just keep us awake at night. As we keep trying to find the way through, and there's no way through. For some of us, we just develop a headache that doesn't seem to go away, it just sits there the whole time. For some of us, it just disturbs our whole digestive system. Emotionally, we react in all kinds of ways. For some of us, we'll just start shouting, because we've got to say something. And for some of us, we just go quiet. Because what is there to say? Some of us, we will go around blaming ourselves all the time. It's all my fault. Round and round it spins in our heads. For others, we blame everybody else. It's all your fault. Because I'm hurting. And somebody needs to get hurt. And round it goes in our heads. And we've got this Gordian knot. And no one can untie it. The Lord can. We have to come back to him. Acts 15 is a cliff edge. Acts 15, one wrong step and the Christian church is off over the edge and smashing into little pieces on the floor. It could cause so much harm if James stands up and says, well, I'm against Peter. We can't be doing with this mixing stuff with Gentiles. But the Lord had prepared James, the Lord had prepared an answer, and maybe Paul didn't realise it was going to come, or maybe he did, I don't know. But the Lord had given an answer in James. The very man who could have caused endless trouble is actually the man who heals the situation and provides the answer. Now we've got to believe the Lord can do this. And if you're anything like me, you'll say at that moment, yeah, I don't really believe that often. I just get myself in situations where I'm completely wound up and I don't think he's going to step in and do anything. Because we're prone to that sort of unbelief. But we need the Lord to help us with our unbelief and have faith in him. We do not have to solve all life's problems in our own strength. It doesn't work. But we can trust the one who has power over all things to solve problems and entrust ourselves to him. One tiny example before we go on. Paul once had to deal with a church in Macedonia, where Alexander the Great came from, a place called Philippi, named after Alexander's dad. And the church there, they had got some people having a stinking row, and Paul had to write to them and said, look, will you please calm this down? Can you stop falling out with each other? And here's the advice he gave to them to calm down their disagreement. He said, look to the Lord, Philippians 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. Look, I'll say it again. Rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. Okay, so for the last X months, your anger has been evident to all. Well, now let your gentleness be evident to all. Why? The Lord is near. It's the Lord who's going to solve this. Will you please look to him? Do not be anxious about anything. Okay, so you've lived with all this anxiety about whatever it is you're bickering about. Stop being anxious about it, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, let's have a bit more thankfulness there, he says. Present your request to God. Is he God or not? Do you think he can answer or not? Bring your arguments to him. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Paul said to his friends in Philippi, have faith in the Lord. See this argument healed. Take it to him. There was a really intense problem in Acts 15. It could have broken things apart. The Lord provided an answer. So, number two, what was the answer? Now, in explaining James' answer, we're going to get a little bit detailed. Try to stay with me. James goes to the Old Testament. There's something to remember immediately. The Lord often provides his answers where? From his word. That's the thing that guides us in life. From his word. James goes to the Old Testament and he reads the prophet Amos, whom we read from earlier. Amos, as I said, preached in northern Israel. He's sort of 700 plus years before Christ. Israel had treated God very badly. Now the empire of Assyria from the north was going to enslave her. God couldn't take Israel's idolatry and law-breaking any longer. But Amos, in chapter 9, right at the end of the little book, promises there'll be light after the darkness. At the end of the book, he gives hope of a better day of freedom and life again for Israel after the exile. And he says, what will be the sign of this new era? The sign will be a tent. You will see a tent being put back up, he says. And that will be the sign of a new and better day. But it's not just any tent. It is the tent, he says, of King David. King David's long-lost tent of worship. Here's the quote from Amos. This is Amos 9 that we read earlier. In that day I will restore David's fallen tent. I will repair its broken places, restore its ruins, and build it as it used to be, so that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations that bear my name, declares the Lord, who will do these things. David's tent of worship, what is that? God gave two special titles to King David. He called him the Son of God. Now, he didn't mean that David was divine. David's stories show that he is very, very human in many ways. But as Israel's king, God said, now, because you're the king of Israel, and Israel is my people, I will treat you like my son, as though your throne on earth is an extension of my throne in heaven. So, this is Psalm 2, which, if I had my quotes here, then I'd be able to read to you, but I don't at the moment. Have I got them somewhere? If I haven't, I need to go hunting for them. Now I've got to go hunting for them. So, in Psalm 2, it says this. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask of me and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. God said to David, your kingdom that I have put you on the throne of, the kingdom of my people Israel. It isn't just in your power. As it were, you rule because I have extended my rule to you. I have the true throne in heaven. But I have allowed you to have a throne on the earth. And any power you have is just derived from me. And so he refers to him as his son in that sense. And then secondly, God gave the title to David of a priest. This is in Psalm 110. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. God said to David, not only are you a king, you are a priest. Your kingdom will be close to heaven, as it were. You will be in touch with heaven and you will represent your people before me. Your kingdom will be like a little extension of heaven. Your authority and power you have because I have extended my authority and power to you. And you will be close to me. You will be able to approach me in worship and bring your people to me in worship. David, I'm making you a priest king. Psalm 2, Psalm 110. Now, that had actually been seen before in Jerusalem. That's why in Psalm 110 it mentions this man Melchizedek. Melchizedek had been a priest king in Jerusalem before. David, as it were, was reviving that ancient line with God's permission. And so in Jerusalem, in David's day, suddenly there was a new closeness to God, like they'd never seen before. They had a king upon the earth who was also a priest upon the earth and whom God was embracing in a way he hadn't embraced anyone else, and that king could bring the people to worship God. And where would it happen? In a tent. In Jerusalem. That David put up. David's worship tent. Now at the heart of that tent he put the Ark of the Covenant. 2 Samuel 6 describes the day that David did this, when he first set it up. Why did he put the Ark of the Covenant in the tent? Well, the Ark of the Covenant was something built by Moses. You can read about it in Exodus. It was a gold box that Moses built at God's command. And it represented the presence of God on the earth. So it made perfect sense for David to put it in the middle of his tent. Because now God has said, you are my son. God has said, you are my priest. God had said, in Jerusalem, you can bring people to worship me. So David brought the box that represented God's presence and he put it in the middle of his tent. And that became the symbol of what God had done. Now previously, it had been hidden. When they carried it, they covered it up. And when it settled anywhere, it was in the middle of the Moses tent. We call it the tabernacle. And there were like a couple of security barriers before you could get anywhere near it. And in fact, normally the only person who ever saw it was the high priest, and that once a year. But a new day had dawned with King David. The Ark of the Covenant could come out. It could go into the middle of David's tent of worship, and people could gather to know God. The box itself was like a model of the Garden of Eden. Inside the box was the Ten Commandments. You remember the Garden of Eden had this tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Well, the Ten Commandments are the knowledge of good and evil. It had a model of that. It had the manna. It had a little pot of the food that God had given. You remember the Garden of Eden? God filled it full of food for Adam and Eve to eat. It had a little model of the food that God gave the Israelites. Not model, sorry. It had a little pot of the food God gave the Israelites in the desert. Inside the Ark of the Covenant was this stick that Aaron had had. But the stick had come to life. It was like a model of the tree of life. God had made something come to life, miraculously, powerfully. It was kept in the Ark of the Covenant. The box was sealed with a couple of golden cherubim, spiritual creatures on top, models of them. You may remember that when Adam and Eve were thrown out of the Garden of Eden, cherubim, real ones, guarded the gate to not allow them back in. So I want you to picture what's going on in David's Jerusalem. People would come into the city. They would come up to this tent that was near to David's palace. They would enter into this tent. The king would be there at the front leading the worship because he's a priest king. There would be this golden box. And the golden box would be like a tiny model of the great Garden of Eden that you'd heard about in the readings from Genesis. And it would feel amazing. It would feel as though for a moment in time, God had stepped you back to what was lost at the start of the world. As though you could stand at Eden's gates once again, and you could know there was a heavenly garden in there, with the knowledge of good and evil, with the food of God, with the tree of life. And there at the gate was a man who was speaking through the gate to God, and you were with him. It was a remarkable worship that went on in this tent. No wonder David wrote so many psalms. It was a moment of blessing in Jerusalem like they had never known. For a moment in time, it wasn't a case of, if you were lucky, you could stand outside in the courtyard of Moses' tabernacle and hear the priests talk about the high priest who himself had been allowed in where the box was. You could go with the king into the presence of God. The worship in David's worship tent was so much more open than what was offered in the tabernacle of Moses. The tabernacle of Moses still existed, by the way. That was down in a place called Gibeon. And there were still priests down there who were busy doing their stuff and making sacrifices, etc., etc., etc. David didn't despise what Moses had set up. He didn't despise the laws of Moses. But he knew that God had given him something better. There in Jerusalem, a worship tent was open. And even Gentiles could go in. If you read 2 Samuel 6 and 1 Chronicles 16, you'll meet Gentiles who go into the tent of worship. For a moment in time in Jerusalem, there was just this beautiful period where worship went on like Israel had never known, because David, the priest king of Jerusalem, had been installed by God. It was lovely. And of course, in that, it really does point us to what God truly desires. God does want the gathering of all peoples into his presence to know him and love him. He wants men, women and boys and girls from all over the world to know him, to love him, to experience him. He is working for that day, which was once glimpsed in Eden's garden, but one day will come to all its fullness, when God and man will live together, where they'll share the great home that God will build. When you hear the phrase David's tent, try to see what sits behind it. Try to recapture the golden age that existed in Jerusalem for a few years under King David. And hear the Lord calling to you. This is what I desire. People who come close to me. People who know me. Now, that golden era died. David soon realised that as a fallen man, he couldn't sustain a kingdom like this. He couldn't sustain that type of relationship with God. He wasn't capable of it. And the Lord agreed with him. When David said to God, you know, why don't we put you up a palace? Why don't we put you up a temple, same word, in Jerusalem? Why don't we remove the tent and put something solid up? Well, when David suggested that, making it more solid, God says, oh no, I don't think so. You're a killing machine. I don't think we'll have you doing that. That's in 1 Chronicles 22. But God said, I'll tell you what I'll do though. I'll make you a promise. I promise that I will build your house, by which he meant his family, until a son is born into your house who can do that. Now the next king, Solomon, he sort of hinted at that promise in what he did. He actually did build a temple in Jerusalem. It was a bit of a limited place. In the first, to start with, they put the Ark of the Covenant back in a secret room and no one could get to it except the high priest. And secondly, a few hundred years later, it was all pulled down again anyway. It wasn't very long lasting. But that was just a hint. What God had said to David was this: look, what you've seen during these golden years, I'm going to implement one day. A son will come from your line who will be the ultimate priest king, who will really bring people back to Eden's garden and in through the gate and into the presence of God to enjoy God forever. I promise you, David, you can do it. You're a man of blood. But you will have a son and he will do it. And that is the Lord Jesus, the eternal Son of God. Now, if you stay with me, I'm sorry it's so detailed, but it brings us all back to Amos. Hundreds of years after David had done all of that, Amos turns up and he starts prophesying about this tent of worship. And he says, That tent will come back. He picks up, as it were, on the promise God had made. And he says, there's got to be a day. There's got to be a day when a son of David will again establish worship that will be free, that will be open, where people will enter into the presence of God and know him. And it will be people of every sort. Jewish people and Gentile people. Jewish people and non-Jewish people. It's got to happen one day. And in Acts 15, James says, amen, brother. And I can see it. I mean, to feel the excitement James must have felt. This man loved Jerusalem. He loved his Jewish history, his people. And as it were, he stood in Jerusalem that day and he said, I look and I see David's tent is back up. It's returned. That golden age has dawned. And where does he see it? He sees it in the Christian church. Up on the hill is the golden temple. There's nothing in there. The inner room is empty. God made clear that was the case when he ripped open the curtain a few years earlier. There's no Ark of the Covenant in that temple. It's just like David's day. It's an empty box. But James says, but just like David's day too, there is a tent where God is present. And it's the church, because the Holy Spirit's been given to us. And James suddenly, it's like, he can see everything clearly. And he looks around the room, and if there are Gentiles present, he says, I have no problem with being with these Gentiles. I have no problem in worshipping with these Gentiles. I have no problem in eating with these Gentiles. I have no problem in seeing these Gentiles as my brothers. Because we're back in David's tent. I don't have to give up being a Jew, but Titus doesn't have to give up being a Gentile. Because we're back in David's tent. The king who is a priest stands before us, and it's Christ. And God is present, but not in a box. Model, he is present by his spirit. And we have come back to Eden where we eat and drink together of the food of God. And we've got David's tent back, like Amos said, but better than David's tent. And once he's caught that glimpse, James can then say, it's my judgment, therefore, that we should not make it difficult for the Gentiles who are turning to God. James says, no more trouble. The prophets have told us to expect the day we're in. Let's live it out and enjoy it. Well, next sermon, we'll see the special arrangements that James goes on then to suggest to help that work out in practice. There's some practical matters he's going to have to deal with to wrap up. But finish just with these two lessons. Number one, where does James find his answers? He finds them in Scripture. The Bible teaches you how to live as an individual Christian. It teaches us how to live as a church. It's why we study it. It's why we take time to try and understand it. It's why we do what we've just done for the last 30 minutes. We need God's help to do it. We need God to open our eyes to the bits that bewilder and confuse us. We want exciting moments like James had, where suddenly words just come alive and you can almost see them living out in front of you the way James did, when suddenly he looked at the Christian church and said, it's David's tent! It's back! The Bible is a sure guide to life. As Christians, we've got to value it the way James did. But then the second thing we've got to value is just the church. When we come together as the church, we enter David's tent, which means we return in some way to Eden, which means we come close to the Lord. When we gather for worship, it is not a small thing. When we are together with the Lord and he is present by his Spirit, it is a very precious moment. And we need to overcome the unbelief, or the sin, or the coldness, with the Lord's help, though in any way would tell us otherwise. When we feel like just staying away because we can't be bothered with it, We need to capture again the vision that James had, that he picked up from Amos, that Amos saw in David. We need to see the reality of God meeting with his people and find how precious again it is.